Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 5th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's our famous, well, not so famous, Labor Day compilation. We're all on vacation, having a barbecue or picking up after our kids, depending on which one of us I'm referring to, from the office. We do this every year. I try and change up the compilation. For a couple of years, we did one compilation. Last year, we did another. This year will be some repeats from last year, some new stuff. New stuff gets put on a line, and I try and catch up to it. Keep trying to find the full version of John Lewis's radio address, Democracy in Steel. And I found a short 2-minute version of it. But this is what we've got for you today, ladies and gentlemen. And I just listened to last year's intro, and it was really long and annoying. So I'm going to try and be a little bit less long and annoying. We have a compilation of a Studs Terkel story about the relevance of Labor Day. Terkel told this story in many different venues. Somebody cut together a compilation. This is it. Then we'll go to that brief clip of John Lewis's Democracy in Steel speech given in July 1936. Very important speech in the history of the labor movement, one which was seen as a admonition to FDR to do something on behalf of labor and normal people. And then Francine Perkins, first female Secretary of Labor on the shirtwaist fire. That is one that we did from last year. And then three clips. One of Eugene Debs himself. Off the top of my head now, I don't know what that speech is. The first one is, oh, wait a second. Here it is. It's Eugene Debs' Winning a World speech. Then a speech of his that was performed by Mark Ruffalo as part of the Howard Zinn Voices of the People. This is back in 2008, Ruffalo recorded. It's about 4 minutes long. And then another Eugene Debs piece from a book on tape, which the introduction is part of that. So it will come up. And then we're going to hear a speech by Harry Truman when he vetoed the Taft-Hartley bill in 1947. Now, Richie Selson, who was the one who suggested we use this, said to me at the time that he said, you know, Truman probably was not this concerned about the Taft-Hartley, but he knew it would be overridden by Congress, and it was. Taft-Hartley passed. But it suggested just how powerful the unions were at that time, that Truman had to make it sound like he was really concerned about it. And as I was listening last year's intro, and it still resonates with me, I can't believe it was a year ago, but It just goes to show you that it really doesn't matter what's in people's hearts. What really matters in terms of the politicians is the power you bring to the table. So those are the speeches that we have for you this year. If you have any suggestions, email us and we'll put them in next year's compilation. All right, we'll be back live tomorrow. And here are those speeches. We may break them up with just a little bit of music in between. And have a great Labor Day. We'll be back live tomorrow. Thanks, folks.
I was waiting for a bus a few days before Labor Day, and I live in a neighborhood that's a half street in a sea of have-nots, and this is a half couple.
He's in Brooks Brothers, and he's got the fresh minted Wall Street Journal under his arm, and she's a looker. She's got Bloomingdale, Neiman Marcus clothes, latest issue Vanity Fair.
And I can't make any conversation with him for a whole year. I see him every day waiting for the bus.
And so I talk to myself out loud. And by the way, I find that audience very appreciative.
So I say, Labor Day's coming up. That is the worst thing I could possibly have said. He looks at me. He gave me that look that no old coward would give to a speck of dirt on a cup. And he turns away.
And that was a challenge. The bus is late in coming. I say, Labor Day's the day we march down Michigan Boulevard, Chicago's main thoroughfare. Banners held high, steel workers, union auto workers, farm equipment workers, packing house.
Which side are you on? Solidarity forever. He turns to me and he says, we despise unions. And I say, oh, I got a pigeon here.
Now I become the Ancient Mariner, fixing him with a glittering eye. And I say, how many hours a day do you work? It's something of a non sequitur, so he's caught unaware. So he says, 8. This time I got him pinned against the mailbox.
Why don't you work 16 hours a day? 16, yeah, because your great-grandparents worked 16 hours a day.
And I say, you know why you work 8, not 18? Because 4 guys got hanged 100 years ago. It's the Haymarket Affair in Chicago.
They were campaigning. Old German anarchists and others campaigned for the 8-hour day. And there was a big gathering, and someone threw a bomb. No one knows who. A couple of cops were killed and people. And the people who were speaking there, and long ago gone, were convicted of conspiracy, and of the 8 people convicted, 4 were hanged. And you know what they were fighting for? The 8-hour day. So these 4 guys were hanged for you.
By this time, the couple is somewhat trembling, and the bus comes, and I never saw them again.
To this day, I know she's up on the 35th floor of the high-scale high-rise. He looked down, he says, is the old nut still down there?
Now, it's easy to blame this young couple, but now you think about it. What do they know about labor? You pick up, let alone Wall Street Journal, pick up the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, the prestigious. You have a feature section.
They've got a sports section, of course. They've got style, fashion, theater, gossip. They've got a business section all about LBOs and about downsizing, which, of course, a euphemism for mass firings. We know that.
But is there a labor section? Because this is a joke, a labor section. Is there a labor page? Is there a labor column? Once in a while, you have a bit about Pickett may have thrown a rock at a scab, but it's a story. Or today, the humiliation of the United Auto Workers in Decatur, Illinois, going back to Caterpillar. But there is no coverage, so how would they know about that?
Is this making sense to you?
Sounds great to me.
You're not going to use anything of this. Tell Charlie run the tape as it is. They won't do it. Of course not. Nothing's changed. Return to the moon. I'm tired. Return to the moon.
My Voice Tonight will be the voice of millions of men and women employed in America's industries, economically exploited and inarticulate, who heretofore had been denied by industry and finance the privilege of collective organization and collective participation in the arbitrary fixation of their economic status. Let him who will, be he economic tyrant or sordid mercenary, pit his strength against this mighty upsurge of human sentiment for the establishment of economic freedom and industrial democracy. The issue involves the security of every man or woman who works for a living by hand or by brain. The issue cuts across every major economic, social, and political problem now pressing with incalculable weight upon the 130 millions of people in this nation. It is an issue of whether the working population of this country shall have a voice in determining their own destiny, or shall serve as indentured servants for a financial and economic dictatorship which would shamelessly exploit our natural resources and debase the soul and destroy the pride of a free people. On such an issue, there can be no compromise for labor or for a thoughtful citizenship. I call upon the workers in the iron and steel industry who are listening to me tonight to throw off their shackles of servitude and join our union of their industry. I call upon the workers in the textile, lumber, rubber, automotive, and other unorganized industries to join with their comrades in the steel industry and establish yourselves as free men and women in every economic, social, and political sense.
But I saw one of fish from a colorblind witch, 'cause she said she loved it. I couldn't tell her the part that would break.
Al Smith had never heard the words New Deal. He was governor of the state of New York. He had been in the legislature before. As a member of the legislature, he was the majority leader. He could have appointed anybody he wanted to the Factory Investigating Commission, but he had himself appointed to the Factory Investigating Commission, so that he could see with his own eyes what was going on. As he said, this is too raw. We can't have any mistakes here. We can't make any blunders. And I'm going to sit there myself. I'm not going to turn this over to somebody else. And so he appointed himself to the Factory Investigating Commission in 1911, which was the year of the Great Triangle Fire in New York City, a terrible industrial accident which burned out the contents of a ninth and tenth floor loft building factory where they made light cotton shirt waists for women. It caught on fire and the blaze spread very rapidly. There was only one means of exit available. The other two means of exits were the elevator, which was ablaze almost immediately as the flames got into this open shaft and spread from floor to floor, and the second other exit was locked. It was an exit to the roof, not a very good means of exit at best, but it would have saved most of the people in that building if it had not been locked. It had been locked by the employer himself because he feared that on a Saturday afternoon, which he was working just before Easter on a lot of shirt waste for the market, he feared that some of the people in the shop might stroll out through this over the roof exit with a few shirt waste rolled up under their jackets, or that somebody might come in and take a few shirt waste. In other words, I only know what he said on the stand. He was afraid he would be robbed by his employees or by the outsider. Not so much by the outsider, mostly afraid of his employees. And I remember the judge, in righteous indignation, reproached him for his attitude toward his employees. It may have been a perfectly legitimate attitude. He may have lost goods that way. One doesn't know, but it was at least a bad judgment to tell it to the judge on that particular occasion. At any rate, this was a terrible accident. 147 young people, they were all young men and women, were killed, lost their lives, and a number of others were badly injured. Some of them were injured And after the fire in the elevator shaft had gone out, of course the boys that ran the elevator had gone, had fled, and some of the people tried to get out by jumping into the elevator shaft and grabbing the cables and letting themselves down that way. Some of them fell, some of them were awkward and didn't grab right, don't you know, and couldn't hold on. Some of them merely ruined, blistered their hands, took the skin and flesh off their hands coming down on the cables. So there were a number of people sadly injured. Everybody who jumped, and a good many did jump from the 9th and 10th floors, was killed. And the other people who died were all people who were burned or smothered by the smoke in the factory itself. This made a terrible impression on the people of the state of New York. I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere. It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. Mea culpa, mea culpa. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face. I remember that Al Smith, the accident happened on a Saturday. I happened to have been visiting a friend in the park, on the other side of the park, and we heard the engines and we heard the screams and rushed out and rushed over where we could see that the trouble was. We could see this building from Washington Square, and the people had just begun to jump when we got there. They'd been holding until that time, standing in the windowsills, crowding, being crowded by others behind them. The fire pressing closer and closer, the smoke closer and closer. Finally, the men were trying to put up, trying to get out this thing that the firemen carry with them, a net to catch people if they do jump. And they were trying to get that out, and they couldn't wait any longer. I mean, they began to jump. This one, the window was too crowded, and they would jump, and they hit the sidewalk. The net broke. The embassy is terrible at distance, and the weight of the bodies was so great at the speed at which they were traveling that they broke through the net. Every one of them was killed. Everybody who jumped was killed, and it was a horrifying spectacle. We had our dose of it that night and felt as though we had been part of it all. The next day, people, as they heard about it in other parts of the city, they began to mull around and gather and talk. And I remember that Al Smith, who was not a governor at that time but a member of the legislature, a majority leader in the assembly, found that many, many of these young people were residents of the same district he was a resident of. And he did the most natural and humane thing. He said, I did it just as I would if they died of anything else. You know, you go to see their father and mother to try to help them. He went to the places where they lived. He went to the tenement they had occupied to see their father and mother and tell them how sorry he was, or their husband, as the case might be, or their wife, to tell them of his sympathy and grief. It was a human, decent, natural thing to do. And it was a sight he never forgot. I mean, it burned it into his mind. He also got to the morgue, I remember, at just the time when the survivors were being allowed to sort out the dead and see who was theirs and who could be recognized. And he went along with a number of others to the morgue to support and help, you know, the old father or the sorrowing sister do her terrible picking out. This was the kind of shock that we all had. And the next Sunday they had a meeting. A meeting was called in the Metropolitan Opera House, which was a large available place. And there, by this time, we got a little sense of organization of something must be done. We've got to turn this into some kind of victory, some kind of constructive action. And so this meeting voted to accept a sum of money of $25,000, which Mr. R. Fulton Cutting had telegraphed. He was ill in bed in somewhere in South Carolina with pneumonia, but he had telegraphed to one of the people who were getting up the meeting, you must have a meeting, the citizens must take action about this. The citizens must do something. And to start the ball rolling, I contribute $25,000 now, and others will give more to start it. We must stop. We must make sure that this kind of thing can never happen again in New York City. In New York State, I think he said. And so, almost immediately at this meeting, people spoke. And I never forget, this was the first time I ever had heard Rose Schneiderman speak. I think it's the first time I'd ever seen her, as a matter of fact. She was an unknown little girl, a little red-headed girl. She couldn't have been, she couldn't have come up to my shoulder, very small type, but with red hair, fiery red hair and blazing eyes, and pretty, too. I mean, she had a voice that was that carried in the Metropolitan Opera House. Wonderful, what a speech she made. And I remember how moved we all were by this girl who was a member of that union, you see, the Ladies' Dress and Waist Union. She was a member of that union, and not all of these members, because it wasn't a union shop, not all of these members, but many of them were members of her union. Anyhow, they were all eligible for membership in her union. And she took them all in with the most beautiful speech. I think it still exists. I had a copy of it once, and I put it in somebody's archives somewhere. But it was a most moving speech, and should be looked at, because this was what a young girl, not in this country very many years, but she spoke very good English. She'd had good training somewhere, and she spoke without a trace of an accent. And she made a remarkable speech, which really stirred people. At any rate, that was that, and we decided to, we appointed a committee, of course, to carry on. We decided to ask the legislature to create a commission. And this was where Al Smith came in. I went to see him, and another woman went with me, and one man. We went privately. We didn't want to have it known that we were going to see him about this, but I went to ask his advice, because his advice was always good, and if you didn't ask it, he didn't like it. But it was always good. You could afford to take it. And so I went to ask his advice, and he gave me the most useful piece of advice I guess we've ever had. It was this: you're going to form a commission. That's all right. That's a good idea. But let me tell you, don't you appoint, don't get started asking the governor to appoint a commission or anybody else to appoint a commission of citizens. Citizens is all right, he said, but they've got to be where they belong. If you want to get anything done, you've got to have this a legislative commission. If the legislature does it, the legislature will be proud of it, the legislature will listen to their report, and the legislature will do something about it. But if the governor appoints the commission, they'll just give it the cold shoulder. They won't pay any attention to it. Well, I thought that was absurd at the time, but I learned by long experience that it is not absurd. It's the way to do it. This is the way that the legislatures are persuaded to act. They appear to have taken the lead. And once they have said, all right, go ahead, then it's their responsibility to do something about it. And the New York State Legislature did exactly that. They appointed the commission. They asked the governor to appoint two citizens to represent him. So we had citizen representation, and we had a citizen council, Abram Elkus, and the two citizen members were Mary Dreyer, a devoted, what would be called a New Dealer today, but a devoted, public-private servant. interested in and devoted to the promotion of the welfare of the people. Abram Elkus was the council, a man who was not a government man, but was a governor's appointment. and the others were members of the Senate and members of the Assembly. And we had both Democrats and Republicans in equal numbers. That's the way to do it, said Al. That's the way to do it, because you can't get these laws through unless you have, the support of both of them. So we proceeded, and it proved to be a most educative experience. This factory investigating commission was continued from year to year, but it sat for 4 years, and its report is I think it's got 7 volumes. It's as long as that on my shelf, and it's in great detail. It's all there. The whole report is there, the recommendations, the testimony. And we went all over the state. I was a young person then and certainly not fit for service on any super commission, but I was the chief, I was an investigator and in charge of the investigations. And this was an extraordinary opportunity, you see, to get into factories to make a report and to be sure it was going to be heard, because you made the report publicly to the governor or to the commission, which sat every Saturday morning for 4 years, except I guess in midsummer we adjourned, something of that sort. But it was a very, very useful commission. While they were at it, although their commission was to devise ways and means to prevent accidents by fire in the state of New York, we went on and kept expanding the function of the commission till it came to be to report on sanitary conditions and to provide for their removal and to report all kinds of unsafe conditions and then to report all kinds of human conditions that were unfavorable to the employers, including long hours, including low wages, including the labor of children, including the overwork of women, including homework put out by the factories to be taken home by the women, included everything, almost everything you could think of that had been in agitation for years. We were authorized to investigate and report and recommend action on all these subjects. And I may say we did. So that beginning with that report coming in, as it did in 1915, it was laid on the table before the legislature, and by this time Al Smith was the Speaker of the House and well on the way to be governor. We had a very favorable audience, and much of the legislation was enacted into law within a couple of years. Hearings and so forth, and bringing up the supporters and modifying the bill. So that we really got a big draw out of that one episode, which, as I've thought of it afterwards, seems in some way to have paid the debt that society owed to those children, those young people who lost their lives in the Triangle Fire. It's their contribution to the people of New York that we have this really magnificent series of legislative acts to protect and improve the administration of the law regarding the protection of work people in the city of, in the state of New York. This was, of course, a great shake-up, not only for the state of New York, but for other states, because New York laid out everything all at once. And we made a pattern that lasted, it lasted clear up until the last Minimum Wage Act, I guess, was... I mean, the first of these minimum wage acts was passed in Franklin Roosevelt's first administration as governor. And from 1915 on, we'd been eating away at this report and its contents and its recommendations, so that we really covered almost everything. Of course, there have been many improvements made in the administration of the law, but we discovered and we applied, we put into the law a new device, and they've done it in some other states too, copying New York. This shows how important New York is, and I won't make the remark I was about to. New York is an important entity and ought to be represented by its own people, I think, but at any rate, we discovered the principle of administrative law. I'd never heard of it at the time, I was as innocent as everybody else. I haven't heard of administrative law, but a lawyer named George Gordon Battle and another one named Wickersham told me about it one Saturday afternoon when I lunched with them, and it sounded very good to me. Administrative law is a very practical method of fitting the law to the particular situation, and to fit it quickly enough. You have a law that says all workplaces shall be conducted in a safe and secure fashion, a safe and sanitary condition. All workplaces shall be all workplaces employing one or more persons. But you always have to get down under the Constitution to the person that's being protected. All workplaces employing one or more persons shall be conducted in a safe and sanitary condition.
Late presidential candidate, Socialist Party, will now address you.
Fellow workers and comrades, the socialist movement is as wide as the world, and its mission is to win the world, the whole world, from animalism and consecrate it to humanity. What a tremendous task, and what a royal privilege to share in it. To win a world is worthy of a race of gods. And in the winning, men develop godlike attributes, since all men are potential gods. What a madhouse the earth would seem today in the frenzied revelry of capitalism, but for the light the socialistic philosophy sheds upon it. What alpine peaks of wealth, and what desert wastes of poverty, despair, and death. What man, unless his heart be adamant, can contemplate this awful scene and be content? What man, unless his brain be atrophied and his vision blinded, can fail to perceive the impending crisis? In the presence of this vast and terrible phenomenon, how satisfying to be enlisted in the socialist movement, to understand its self-dispelling social philosophy, and to interpret passing events in the clear light of its science. The productive mechanism in modern industry, vast, complex, marvelous beyond expression, burns the impotent touch of the individual hand, but leaps as if in joy to its task when caressed by the myriad-fingered collective sun of modern thought. The mute message of the machine could but the worker understand, and would he but heed it. Child of his brain, the machine has come to free and not to enslave, to save and not to destroy the author of its being. Potent and imperious as the command of the industrial Jehovah, the machine compels the grand army of toil to rally to its standards, to recognize its power, to surrender body-breaking and soul-devouring tasks, to join hands in sacred fellowship, to subdivide labor, to equalize burdens, to demand joy and leisure for all, and emancipated from the fetters of the flesh, rise to the sublimest heights of intellectual, moral, and spiritual exaltation. To realize this great social ideal is a work of education and organization. The working classes must be aroused. They must be made to hear the trumpet call of solidarity, economic solidarity, and political solidarity. One great all-embracing industrial union, and one great all-embracing political party, and both revolutionary to the cause, two hearts with but a single soul.
The modern fuel of production must belong to those who made use of it, whose freedom, yea, whose very lives depend upon it. 100 years ago, the collective ownership of the individual tool would have been absurd. Today, the private ownership of the collective tool is a crime. This crime is at the foundation of every other that disfigures society. And from its sub-cellars exudes the festering stenches of our sweatshop civilization. Educate the working class. Fred Wilshire's magazine and the weekly socialist papers, the pamphlets, tracts, and leaflets among the people. The middle class see their doom in capitalism and must soon turn to socialism. The handwriting is on all the billboards of the universe. The worst in socialism will be better than the best in capitalism. The historic mission of capitalism has been to exploit the forces of nature, place them at the service of man, augmenting his productive capacity a thousandfold, to turn, as if by magic, the shallow, sluggish streams into rushing, roaring Niagaras of wealth, leaving to the toilers who produced it the greater poverty, insecurity, and anguish than before. The mission of socialism is to release these imprisoned productive forces from the vandal horde that has seized them, that they may be operated not spasmodically and in the interest of a favored class as at present, but freely and in the common interest of all. Then the world the socialist movement is to win from capitalism, will be filled with wealth for all to have and to enjoy in its abundance. When enough have become socialists, and each day is augmenting the number and making them more staunch and resolute, they will sweep the country on the only vital issue before the nation. A new power will be in control. The people. For the first time in all history, man at last will be free.
Voice against World War I was that of Eugene Debs, the railroad union organizer and leader of the Socialist Party. On June 18, 1918, he addressed a mass rally of workers in Ohio, knowing that his words could lead, as they did, to his arrest and imprisonment. His sentence of 10 years was upheld by unanimous Supreme Court decision. Here is the speech that led to his arrest.
Sam Johnson declared that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. He must have had the Wall Street gentry in mind, or at least their prototypes. For in every age, it has been the tyrant, the oppressor, and the exploiter who has wrapped himself in the cloak of patriotism, or religion, or both, to deceive and overawe the people. Every solitary one of these aristocratic conspirators and would-be murderers claims to be an arch-patriot. Every one of them insists that the war is being waged to make the world safe for democracy. What humbug! What rot! What false pretense! Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. In the Middle Ages, when the feudal lords concluded to enlarge their domains, to increase their power, their prestige, and their wealth, they declared war upon one another. But they themselves did not go to war, any more than the modern feudal lords, the barons of Wall Street, go to war. The feudal barons of the Middle Ages, the economic predecessors of the capitalists of our day, declared all wars, and their miserable serfs fought all the battles. The poor, ignorant serfs have been taught to revere their masters, to believe that when their masters declared war upon one another, it was their patriotic duty to fall upon one another and to cut one another's throats for the profit and glory of the lords and barons who held them in contempt. And what is war in a nutshell? The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. The master class has had all to gain and nothing to lose, while the subject class has had nothing to gain and all to lose, especially their lives. They have always taught and trained you to believe it to be your patriotic duty to go to war and to have yourselves slaughtered at their command. But in all the history of the world, you, the people, have never had a voice in declaring war. And strange as it certainly appears, no war by any nation in any age has ever been declared by the people. The working class who fight all the battles, the working class who make the supreme sacrifices, the working class who freely shed their blood and furnish their corpses, have never yet had a voice in either declaring war or making peace. It is the ruling class that invariably does both. They alone declare war, and they alone make peace. Yours not to reason why, yours but to do and die. That is their motto. And we object on the part of the awakening workers of this nation, if war is right, let it be declared by the people.
Information or to volunteer, please visit us at www.LibriVox.org. Crimes of Carnegie. Protest against condoning crime in the name of philanthropy, says Eugene V. Debs. By Eugene V. Debs. Published in Missouri Socialist, Volume 1, Number 15, April 13, 1901, page 2. Many thousands of misguided people are applauding the alleged philanthropy of Andrew Carnegie, and of these by far the larger number are workingmen. Manifestly they have forgotten, or they have never heard of the horrors of Homestead, or perhaps they are too ignorant to understand or too cowardly to profit by the bloody lesson. The reckless prodigality of Carnegie with the plunder of his victims brings into boldest prominence the crimes he committed when they protested against his monstrous rapacity. Then what? An army of 300 Pinkerton mercenaries were hired by this bloody benefactor to kill the men whose labor had made him a millionaire. He did not have the courage to execute his own murderous designs, so he commissioned another monster, Frick, by name, with bloodless veins and a heart of steel, to commit the crimes while he went to Europe and held high carnival with the titled snobs there until the ghastly work was done. It was one of the foulest conspiracies ever concocted against the working class, and the very thought of its atrocities, after nearly 10 years, fires the blood and crimsons the cheeks with righteous indignation. Not only were the Pinkerton murderers hired by Carnegie to kill his employees, but he had his steelworks surrounded by wires charged with deadly electric currents, and by pipes filled with boiling water, so that in the event of a strike or lockout, he could shock the life out of the very wretched bodies, or scald the flesh from their miserable bones. And this is the man who proposes to erect libraries for the benefit of the working class. and incidentally for the glory of Carnegie. Will the working men of this country accept any gift from the hands of Carnegie, red with the blood of their slain comrades? That some of them have already done so is to their everlasting shame. The employees who a few days ago received, with expressions of gratitude, the bonded booty, to be held in trust for them until they become paupers, have debased themselves beyond expression. They may have to work for Carnegie, but they are not compelled to recognize as a gift the pennies he throws to them in return for the dollars he stole from them. And when they do, they are guilty of treason to their murdered brothers, and are better described as spineless poltroons than as self-respecting working men. Some years ago, when Carnegie endowed the first library for the alleged benefit of working men, I objected. And I object now with increased emphasis. Such a library is monumental of the degeneracy of the working class. It is a lasting rebuke to their intelligence and their integrity. The working men of Newcastle have led the revolt. Let their splendid example be followed wherever a Carnegie library is suggested. Let mass meetings of working men be held, and let the horrifying scenes of the Homestead Massacre be presented to stir them to a sense of indignation at the vulgar and insulting display of the spoil exploited from their class. Let honest workingmen everywhere protest against the acceptance of a gift which condones crime in the name of philanthropy. Let them put themselves upon record in terms that appeal to the honor of their class and the respect of all mankind. We want libraries, and we will have them in glorious abundance when capitalism is abolished and the workingmen are no longer robbed by the philanthropic pirates of the Carnegie class. Then the library will be as it should be, a noble temple dedicated to culture and symbolizing the virtues of the people. Eugene Debs, March 30, 1901.
President of the United States.
My fellow countrymen, at noon today, I sent to Congress a message vetoing the Taft-Hartley labor bill. I vetoed this bill because I am convinced it is a bad bill. It is bad for labor, bad for management, and bad for the country. I had hoped that the Congress would send me a labor bill I could sign. I have said before, and I say now, that we need legislation to correct abuses in the field of labor relations. Last January, I made specific recommendations to the Congress as to the kind of labor legislation we should have immediately. I urged that the Congress provide for a commission to be made up of representatives of the Congress, the public, labor, and management, to study the entire field of labor-management relations, and to suggest what additional laws we should have. I believe that my proposals were accepted by the great majority of our people as fair and just. If the Congress had accepted those recommendations, we would have today the basis for improved labor-management relations. I would gladly have signed a labor bill if it had taken us in the right direction of stable, peaceful labor relations, even though it might not have been drawn up exactly as I wished. I would have signed a bill with some doubtful features. If taken as a whole, it had been a good bill. But the Taft-Hartley bill is a shocking piece of legislation. It is unfair to the working people of this country. It clearly abuses the right which millions of our citizens now enjoy to join together and bargain with their employers for fair wages and fair working conditions. Under no circumstances could I have signed this bill. The restrictions that this bill places on our workers go far beyond what our people have been led to believe. This is no innocent bill. It is interesting to note that on June 4th, Congressman Hartley, on the floor of the House of Representatives, made the following statement, and I quote, "You are going to find there is more in this bill than may meet the eye." This is a revealing description of this bill by one of its authors. There is so much more in it than the people have been led to believe that I am sure that very few understand what the Taft-Hartley bill would do if it should become law. That is why I'm speaking to you tonight. I want you to know the real meaning of this bill. We have all been told by its proponents that this is a moderate bill. We have been told that the bill was harsh and drastic when it was first passed by the House of Representatives, but that the Senate had persuaded the House to drop out the harsh provisions, and that the final bill, the bill sent to me, was mild and moderate. But I found no truth in the claims that the bill sent to me was mild or moderate. I found that the basic purpose and much of the language of the original House of Representatives bill were still in the final bill. In fact, the final bill follows the provisions of the original House bill in at least 36 separate places. We have all been told that the Taft-Hartley bill is favorable to the wage earners of this country. It has been claimed that workers need to be saved from their own folly, and that this bill would provide the means of salvation. Some people have called this bill the Workers' Bill of Rights. Let us see what this bill really would do to our working men. The bill is deliberately designed to weaken labor unions. When the sponsors of this bill claim that by weakening unions, they are giving rights back to individual working men, they ignore the basic reason why unions are important in our democracy. Unions exist so that laboring men can bargain with their employers on a basis of equality. Because of unions, the living standards of our working people have increased steadily until they are today the highest in the world. A bill which would weaken unions would undermine our national policy of collective bargaining. The Taft-Hartley bill would do just that. It would take us back in the direction of the old evils of individual bargaining. It would take the bargaining power away from the workers and give more power to management. This bill would even take away from our working men some bargaining rights which they enjoyed before the Wagner Act was passed 12 years ago. If we weaken our system of collective bargaining, we weaken the position of every working man in the country. This bill would again expose workers to the abuses of labor injunctions. It would make unions liable for damage suits for actions which have long been considered lawful. This bill would treat all unions alike. Unions which have fine records with long years of peaceful relations with management would be hurt by this bill just as much as the few troublemakers. The country needs legislation which will get rid of the abuses. We do not need and we do not want legislation which will take fundamental rights away from our working people. We have been told that the Taft-Hartley bill is a means by which the country can be protected from nationwide strikes in vital industries. The terms of the bill do not support this claim. Many people are under the impression that this bill would prevent or settle a strike in the coal industry. I sincerely trust that the coal operators and the miners will soon come to an agreement on the terms of a contract and that there will be no interruption of coal mining. But if the miners and the operators do not reach agreement, and if this bill should become law, it is likely that the most that could be accomplished under the complicated procedures of the bill would be postponement of a strike from July until October. Under this bill, a work stoppage in the coal mines might be prevented for 80 days, and then, if agreement had not been reached, the miners would be free to strike, and it would be mandatory for the president to refer the whole matter to Congress, even if Congress were not in session. Postponing a strike in the coal industry until the approach of winter, when our need for coal is acute, is certainly not the way to protect the nation against the dangers of a shortage of coal. The bill would not aid fair and early settlement of disputes in vital industries. We have been told by the supporters of the Taft-Hartley bill that it would reduce industrial strife. On the contrary, I am convinced that it would increase industrial strife. The bill would soon upset security clauses in thousands of existing agreements between labor and management. These agreements were mutually arrived at and furnish a satisfactory basis for relations between worker and employer. They provide stability in industry. With their present types of agreements outlawed by this bill, the parties would have to find a new basis for agreement. The restrictions in this bill would make the process of reaching new agreements a long and bitter one. The bill would increase industrial strife because a number of its provisions deprive workers of legal protection of fundamental rights. They would then have no means of protecting these rights except by striking. The bill would open up opportunities for endless lawsuits by employers against unions, and by unions against employers. For example, it would make employers vulnerable to an immense number of lawsuits, since grievances, however minor, could be taken into court by dissatisfied workers. Insofar as employers are concerned, I predict that if this bill should become law, they would regret the day that it was conceived. It is loaded with provisions that would plague and hamper management. It is filled with hidden legal traps that would take labor relations out of the plant where they belong and place them in the courts. Another defect is that in trying to correct labor abuses, the Taft-Hartley bill goes so far that it would threaten fundamental democratic freedoms. One provision undertakes to prevent political contributions and expenditures by labor organizations and corporations. This provision would forbid a union newspaper from commenting on candidates in national elections. It might well prevent an incorporated radio network from spending any money in connection with the national convention of a political party. It might even prevent the League of Women Voters, which is incorporated, from using its funds to inform its members about the record of a political candidate. I regard this provision of the Taft-Hartley bill as dangerous a challenge to free speech, as a dangerous challenge to free speech and our free press. One of the basic errors of this bill is that it ignores the fact that over the years we have been making real progress in labor management relations. We have been achieving slow but steady improvement in cooperation between employers and workers. We must always remember that under our free economic system, management and labor are associates. They work together for their own benefit and for the benefit of the public. The Taft-Hartley bill fails to recognize these fundamental facts. Many provisions of the bill would have the result of changing employers and workers from members of the same team to opponents on contending teams. I feel deep concern about what this would do to the steady progress we have made through the years. I fear that this type of legislation would cause the people of our country to divide into opposing groups if conflict is created, as this bill would create it. If the seeds of discord are sown, as this bill would sow them, our unity will suffer and our strength will be impaired. This bill does not resemble the labor legislation which I have recommended to the Congress. The whole purpose of this bill is contrary to the sound growth of our national labor policy. There is still time to enact progressive, constructive legislation during the present session. We need such legislation to correct abuses and to further our advance in labor management relations. We seek in this country today a formula which will treat all men fairly and justly, and which will give our people security in the necessities of life. As our generous American spirit prompts us to aid the world to rebuild, we must at the same time construct a better America in which all can share equitably in the blessings of democracy. The Taft-Hartley bill threatens the attainment of this goal. For the sake of the future of the nation, I hope that this bill will not become law.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want.